was listening to a Jazz Profile, the bass player Bill Falwell, getting down into the nitty-gritty of it just after 6 o'clock on Jazz Profiles, WKCR-FM in New York.
Kitchen tempers, cutting words, boys and You can bring your toys to my house. I'll open up the gate. We'll spend the day together making the sun shine.
A couple of very distinctive pieces of music that helped to exhibit some of the enigmatic properties of the life and career of Bill Falwell, whom you're hearing narrating about the enigmas that he has lived and that he's been and that he's known on our Jazz Profiles program today. These require a little bit of explanation. You heard Bill Falwell speaking at some length about a deep history with Albert Eiler that includes being inspired by his music before ever meeting and playing with him, being asked on the spur to make a trip overseas with Albert in 1966 and spending a good part of, or some part of, the next few months as one of the primary people who Eiler wants to have on his performances and recordings. And then in Bill Falwell's case, feeling a little bit of a pull from different directions as he was beginning to step into the art rock band called Ars Nova that made a couple of records at the same time that he was being asked by Albert Eiler to, on the one hand, continue doing what he had done, play upright bass in a quintet such as had gone overseas in 66, and then eventually to play the Fender bass in the way that he was factoring into the new rock and roll projects that were on his horizon. So there comes this moment in a record called Newgrass, made in September of 1968, when some of those streams finally get together. And if anything, it was Albert Eiler's rock and roll record and his R&B record and his gospel record, all in one, and a highly controversial enterprise that somehow still has the pure and raw energy of Albert Eiler and a lot of other explosives going off, including Bill Falwell playing bass. From that recording project, or some of the lead-ups to it, you heard a piece called Everybody's Movin', with, complete with background vocals by Mary Parks and others, and Albert Eiler singing, this time singing words, and not just singing wordlessly, as you've heard him do earlier in our program in an excerpt from Newport, when that was the topic under discussion. So Everybody's Movin', relative to this 1968 record called New Grass, which interestingly is now on compact disc for the first time in the United States as of, I believe, last year or perhaps 2 years ago. The artist there is Albert Eiler, A-Y-L-E-R, and his bassist Bill Falwell, F-O-L-W-E-L-L, is the subject of this five-hour Jazz Profiles program that is a concentrated study of the many twists and turns in the career of Bill Falwell. Maybe one of the more pretzel-like turns was the way that the Ars Nova experience and Falwell's associations by way of even people like the clarinetist Perry Robinson, who continues to live in the Hoboken, Jersey City area, led Bill Falwell to be known to and then eventually to become at least a peripheral part of a group called the Insect Trust that, like Ars Nova, made a couple of records. Unlike Ars Nova, they never got any sort of real attention, although, interestingly again, the first Insect Trust record called Hoboken Saturday Night is again in print, and you've heard a slice from that recording called Glade Song that includes a myriad of studio effects to add other flavors into the interesting mix that is based on Trevor Kohler, the baritone saxophonist, Luke Faust, who plays harmonica, banjo, electric guitar, and fiddle, Bill Barth, the lead guitarist and steel guitarist, singer Nancy Jeffries was one of the founding members of the group, and an important part of it also is the late musician, better known as perhaps better known as a writer, Robert Palmer, who was a clarinetist and alto saxophonist here and was part of the force behind the core of the Insect Trust. For their ATCO record, Hoboken Saturday Night, there's a lot more than just the core, including Elvin Jones. Elvin Jones, who was the drummer, and this man, Bill Falwell. Here he is again playing bass, and he also plays one of the overdub parts on trumpet in different sections of the recording. There are different players, but here's another way to hear and understand the steps in the story of Bill Falwell that, interestingly, in the years 66, 67, 68, 69, and 70, there's almost an ABABAB interlock of somewhat high-profile R&B and rock and roll records and some of the less high-profile records of a free jazz idol named Albert Eiler. And this is all part of the swirl of what's going on for bass player Bill Falwell. We return to Bill Falwell's narration and to a couple of other musical examples that will illustrate how he turns the corner or continues to turn the corner of the 60s into the 70s, and Bill Falwell can tell you the rest. I'll tell you, though, that at 14 minutes after 6 Eastern Daylight Time in New York, you're listening to Jazz Profiles on WKCR-FM in New York at 89.9. Our program goes until 7 p.m., and its topic again is Bill Falwell.
Come on. Well, he called you up again about a year later in 69 for the next rock and roll record, if you want to think of it that way. Music is the healing force of the universe, right?
Okay. But now that was a different thing. I was working with Insect Trust, and Bill Barth and whatever had a friend who worked with Canned Heat, whatever. And they wanted to meet Albert more than anything else. Tell me.
Henry Vestine. The guitar player.
Yeah, Henry Vestine. Just,
he was crazy to meet Albert Eiler.
Absolutely crazy. And they came over, and the other singer, the singer with Canned Heat.
No, that one I don't know.
And the high voice. They both came over to the house, and we set out to find Albert. You know, Albert and Mary in their Brooklyn apartment.
Where did you find him?
We never did find him. We threw stones at his window, but nobody was home.
This is the place on Nostrand Avenue?
Mm-hmm. I think that was it. You know, you're saying names I seem to recall, you know.
Let me run back one more time. Speaking of names in Brooklyn, when you first met Albert, you met him at the Village Gate, you said.
I thought, yeah.
And he called you out for a rehearsal at his place?
No, it was at...
it was at the Gate.
We rehearsed at the Gate, and I think the Birds were playing there at the same time, and they kind of walked through and just had no idea what was going on.
The Birds. Very interesting.
I just happened to think of that today, so I thought I'd bring it. You know, they just had walked through, and they just...
They couldn't believe their ears.
I guess.
Did you ever go to Albert's place other than this one time you went to...
Oh, yeah. I went there a couple times.
Same place every time? Or yeah. Did he move around?
The same place, pretty much. And it was Mary. And I'd go visit and whatever. I just can't... I can't really recall. I know I was there, you know. And so these two guys really wanted to... Actually, Henry wanted to record with Albert.
Yeah.
And I present to Ed Michelle, and I, you know, everything kind of, well, fell together. And I thought it was cool, you know.
Yeah.
And Henry, it gassed him completely. And I never met him before, but he was just in awe of Albert. And just wanted to play with him. That's all. He'd do anything to play with him.
Was there ever any talk of them playing in public?
No.
Playing a show?
No.
Just wanted to make a record?
Albert just kind of put up with him, I think, basically.
Right. Was that the first time you knew of Isla taking up the bagpipes?
Did he take up the bagpipes?
Plays them on those records.
Jeez.
You remember that?
You know, I don't remember that at all. He played it. It's actually right. They listed me as a composer on some of those tunes, too. So.
Which is correct or not correct?
Well, I mean, they were all blues tunes, and I guess you got to list somebody, but I certainly haven't seen residuals or anything. Are they big sellers? No. Anyway, the bagpipes, I think he just, just sort of appeared. Hey,
Right. Here's something else.
Here's something else.
What about soprano saxophone? Did you ever, for instance, did Albert take a soprano to Europe?
No.
Just tenor?
Just tenor.
He took a soprano to Newport. Is that the way you remember it?
No, I don't remember,
buy it.
I'll buy anything. Are you kidding?
I've been keeping Bill Falwell hostage for a long,
hostage.
Long time. Hostage. And we're creeping through the years little by little.
Yeah, we haven't gotten anywhere yet.
Well, we have introduced the Insect Trust, a band from Hoboken that made, I believe, exactly two records and a minor splash in Hoboken and some splash for those who know the records. They were sort of in the art rock jazz vein that we're speaking in at a liminal point in music and the union of several different personas, if you want, or personae for Bill Falwell, who played bass on part of their second record, if I'm not mistaken.
What the job was, they had made the record, and then they needed a band to go out, because they didn't really have a band. They had, five people or whatever, so they put this band together, and I was, the drummer lived, I don't know, I can't remember if he's on the record, but he must be, because he lived near me, and I said, hey, there's this band, and so we went out and rehearsed.
The five people you're talking about, Luke Faust, I guess, is the pillar personality, and
actually, it was Bill Barth and Nancy Jeffries were, as far as I could tell, were the
nucleus.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Luke was, there was other people there too, but they as time has progressed, that it was only those five people really in the band, as far as I was referred to as a studio musician, which.
Yeah,
I didn't really feel I was. I never,
Well, there was the band, and there was everyone else.
Yeah,
you were everyone else.
I was
just
everyone.
Like Elvin Jones was everyone
that's
else.
That's right.
So it wasn't a lightweight everyone else.
Yeah, we had.
There was one. There's a guy in the band who has some serious heavyweight credentials as an improvising musician as well. Not that everybody in the band didn't. Not that Bill Falwell didn't. But Trevor Kohler kind of falls beyond the pale of a lot of people's discussion because he died in a. I guess a surprising way.
Surprising.
Far too early.
Yeah.
And I think most people, myself included, are disappointed by the way that his recorded legacy and the paucity of it, the lack of recordings, doesn't really measure up to the stature he's had among those who knew him, like Perry or like yourself even.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Trevor Kohler, the baritone saxophonist and reed man in general?
He was the musical. I mean, he made everything work as music. The other people were unschooled or whatever. He wrote the arrangements, made everything work.
Right.
And he was a strong force. And then bringing his name up is it was a very sad end.
We're speaking here with Bill Falwell on many topics, coursing through we went through the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s at an alarming rate. And
now we're kind of stuck in the 60s.
And creeping into the subsequent
into
decades.
The 70s.
Now, I'm going to have to just fade away into the audience, I think, because there's a lot of what happens to Bill Falwell or with Bill Falwell in the 70s that I couldn't even start to tell you about. So maybe you can walk with us.
Can just do a real quickie, you think?
Do it as you see its importance. What do you think the significant steps are for Bill Falwell after the
Bill
Insect
Falwell
Trust?
At there was a juncture when Insect Trust was going to have to get it together, or they were going to move to Memphis to get it together, et cetera, et cetera. They were moving to Memphis. Well, I didn't want to make the move. You know, I had my family here, and I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to make the move. So that's when I opted, so, well, I'm not going to go. That's it. So that's probably why they considered me not part of the band, because I wasn't ready to drop everything and move. And so then I did other musical stuff. I worked, you know, with some little quartet called the 70s or something, and we played, I think, at, you know, around here. And then I did a show, was one of those Shakespearean musicals that were converted to rock and roll. I can't remember which one it was, but they toured, you know, it was an off-Broadway thing, and they toured. And so I can't remember. It was one of those, you know, it was a famous one that other people have done, you know, that kind of thing. So I was on the road show of that, playing with that, and the guys, I got along with the guys okay, a couple of dancers or singers in the thing, and they had called from California. We'd already made our trip to California with Ars Nova, and that was pretty cool, because we got the billboard on Sunset Boulevard of the band, and hung out at the Troubadour, and hey, that was good, you know, and schmoozed with the rockers out there, and there's stuff happening out there. So he called up at one point and said, you know, we're going to produce the show out in California. We want you to be the musical director of it. I said, well, I've never done that. Okay. I trooped my old family and gotten our, and Johnny Papalia was coming. I got him to come along with me. That Papalia, that's his name, Johnny.
That's his name.
So we drove out to California, and I put my family. I had a friend, Ed Ponder, who was in the Army. He was in the Army at the Navy school, but he didn't go to Panama. He went someplace else. He's a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
He had a tough time with that. But he had family in Arizona, so I dropped my wife and daughter in Arizona. This is when things get sticky.
Right.
And then went on to California to put this show together. Everything was, you know, I had a credit card and a couple hundred bucks. And so we got there, and there wasn't anything. You guys were just, you know, blowing hot air. And they're, you know, hey, well, thanks for coming out. Well, there's nothing really happening. But you can hear Neil Young practicing on the next street over. You want to... Holy smokes. And I said, well, here I am. And in the meantime, I had tried to be an actor or whatever, or comedian, doing that stuff too, because I was just trying to make it. So, and I got bit by the Marx Brothers bug through this period as well. And I used to dress up as Harpo and go out into the streets and go everywhere as Harpo and just kind of show up and do Harpo stuff and leave, and then I had a good time. I suppose other people did too. I'm not sure, really. But anyway, so I took my little Harpo with me, and I went out there and ended up met this actor that my wife had known, and he was working out there, and met him, and he was started with Spike Jonze Jr., who was putting together a show for Vegas. He had a booking in Vegas and was trying to put together a show for it. So I played. I went over an audition. I went over as Harpo, and he introduced me to Spike Jonze Jr. And it's just wonderful. They loved it. So he says, "Hey, we can join the band." So I played bass and Harpo with Spike Jonze Jr. All right, there we go. We've dropped off the edge right now. So he was trying to do his daddy's, but he wasn't doing his daddy stuff. He was just trying to do it with the modern, you know, playing
right
those songs. And he, you know, we worked real hard on that. And we had a real gig at the Tropicana a month. wasn't a, seemed like, no, it was maybe, it was a, no, it was a while there, you know. We played with Red Fox, was on the show, and the Anthony and the Imperials, and us, three shows a night, 7 days a week. And it was work.
Yeah.
We had a good time, and in the meantime, I think, yeah, it's just all this personal stuff happened, which we can say that right here. It's personal stuff.
Right.
Just that's personal stuff.
Bad. But your time in California on that stint is a year, a couple of years?
Or? It was actually, I came back, we did the gig, came back, and I was just kind of lost and didn't have a gig, didn't have a home, didn't have anything. And I just, well, I thought I can make it. You know, so I just trooped around for a while and did what I could do, and I did my Harpo for different situations. I met Groucho, and there was a big party in California, and I was Harpo and pinned gardenias on all the women's and men's, and I did it on everybody, just pinned gardenias. I can't remember the guy's name, but I have the article. Anyway, so it was a pretty wild time, and I did a demo of a show with Avery Shriver doing something there, and that was didn't sell. You know, it's tough to make a living in anything. I mean, when you're doing what you think you want to do, and so I got into the Mechanic, the Charles Bronson movie, and they liked me, and they said, "Oh, hey, we want you in our party scene." So I did that, and of course they got fined because I wasn't in SAG yet, so they had to pay my SAG. They got me into SAG, so that was good for me.
Right.
And I did that, and then I just kind of came back to Avery, said, "Geez, your teeth, you know, you're in the movies, you got to look, you know, you're standing there, and your teeth are this big, and you've got a big spot on it." So I went back home to Mommy and got my teeth worked on, and then I went, and things had kind of dried up out in California, and I wasn't working. So I came back, you know, go back home and trying to get it back together, and then came to New York, back to New York, and doing this Billy Superball was the name of this character that I had, because of the Spike Jonze thing and doing all this stuff, somebody said, and that's bass player, Billy Superball. You know, he wrote it in the newspaper, so I thought that, you know, in the Hollywood Reporter or whatever. Right. So, hey, that sounds like a good name. Why not, you know? And then getting an agent out there, I made the mistake saying, and then Billy Superball, and I had pictures made, and of course, we don't want that. But anyway, so I came back to New York after the stop at home to get revved up again. Came to New York and found Luke in the Hoboken crowd. He was back. He was there. And Peter Stanfield, we put together a little bar band, Jersey bar band, called the Hoochie Coochie Dream Band. And we did that for a little bit. And then we played a while. Did the Jersey Shore and stuff, and then I said, well, I'd like to go back to California. So I just flew back to California. And we had, in the meantime, we had seen this, we were in a bar, and this band came in called Mystic Nights, the Oingo Boingo, and they just came in off the street and trooped through and played and did all this stuff and then left. And I thought, that's cool. What a great concept. You know, street theater had everything, you know, good music. So I went out to Cal, and in the meantime, I stayed back with Perry in that period, too. Mm-hmm. Perry Robinson, is that why I'm here?
Oh. I've heard of Perry Robinson.
Perry Robinson, he put up with me through all this stuff. You know, he was always somebody I could, you know, find again, because we were all bitten by the, was he the bug that... Did I catch it from him? Now, oh, Sphinx, we're out there. Anyway, so Perry had a friend, guy staying with him, a young guy, Sam Phipps, tenor saxophone player, who came to... Perry gathers all sorts of people. People come to see him and learn from him, and then they go off and do whatever. So Sam went back to California, and when I got to California, I just kind of showed up someplace, you know. Hey, I'm here. Take me back, you know, California. You love me. And so the guy said, well, there's no place, you know, you don't have any place to stay, et cetera. Sam said, well, you know, my sister's not at home anymore, and they live in Beverly Hills or whatever, and I think I can get my mom to let you room over here for a while. So I moved in with Sam, and I took mime lessons and played music and did this and that, and joined the Oingo Boingo, which was it's become a cult band.
That was the hot ticket.
That was a hot ticket. I thought that was going to be it. But I was, of course, I don't know, 20 years older than all of them, or at least 10.
Right.
And they were, you know, it was Rick Elfman and Danny Elfman, and Danny was just a kid with a lot of talent.
So, somebody looking in, they're leaving?
Oh, that's all right. So, got to whip it up real quick here. So, the Oingo Boingo, I played with them for a while, and then I kind of left them, and something happened, and I went back with them and played with them again, and they become Garth Hudson became their mentor.
Right.
And I was with them for that, and we did some gigs in L.A. and did some gigs in San Francisco, and then because of Garth's connection, we went to Japan.
Wow.
For the Yamaha Music Festival, we went over there, played one song, and for the whole festival, it was a big festival. It was George Chakiris or whatever sang or something, but he couldn't. You know, it was quite an experience. Quite an experience. And so we got back and did some other gigs, and I think I got fired from Oingo Boingo. I think they were, Garth had long talks with Danny, and see, they had changed from the Mystic Knights to the Oingo Boingo, and then where they were doing shows and stuff with Rick, and then Rick kind of left, and then it was Danny's band, and so they were doing more where the spotlight was on Danny, basically, all the time. So it was more centered on Danny and what he wanted to do, and he got a good guitar player, Steve Bartek, and they got their music together, and it just I played Fender and upright with them, but then the Fender became more in the slap stuff, and I didn't know how to do that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they just, so we did a what's that club on, on Hollywood Boulevard? No,
on Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard.
The Whiskey, you mean?
The
Roxy.
The Whiskey or Go-Go? It must have been the Whiskey. So we did a concert there, and Danny jumped up and came down and broke his leg, and that was it. He that was when the chain. That's when he switched over. He called me and said, "Well, we think we're going to look for another bass player, et cetera, et cetera." I said, "Oh, Jesus, not again! Oh, God!" So, you know, that's about 1979, right there. We've gotten up to 1979, and I'd done that. I said, "Oh boy," and there I was in California, and I needed to get a job, so I got a job working, selling chemicals or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. Moved back to Florida, where my brother lives, and was a president of a branch manager of a chemical company, and I worked for him. And then I learned computers and got married again. I had gotten divorced, and then so I learned computers. I did the Bill Gates thing, you know, Beta.
Even maybe sparked by your early experience with the IBM 1401.
Yeah, absolutely. I knew that I could do that too.
Yeah.
And then when the PC came out in 1980, I was, whoa, you know, and I bought myself an Atari and taught myself that, and then the PC came along, and I ran our business on the computer by myself, learned all the software, and since then I did Kelly Girl stuff until I found a company that I worked at the school system in Pinellas County schools as a mock-up newsletter or whatever stuff, and I said, this looks pretty good, because my wife and I, we had a house, and we didn't have any insurance, and there's nothing like
security.
Security.
Yeah.
So here we are. There's the ugly word right there.
Well, let me come back to Bill Falwell, 2002, who's about to make his first musical, we hope, appearance in New York tonight.
If I get there.
Yeah, I've been holding him up for a long, long time. Well, I think that'll be a nice overview. We'll come back for part two at some point in the future.
Well, gee, if there is one.
And we will, no doubt, come back to catch up with Bill Falwell, who has a lot to say. And even since the time of this 2002 interview, there's been a fair amount, as you may have interpolated in listening to it here in 007, that wasn't at that time known, that has since that time become known, including the expansion of the materials with which we can document the early career of Bill Falwell, who is the bass player and erstwhile, and once again, trumpet player, who we've been featuring on this afternoon's program. He's also the narrator, talking about his own life and career in music and some of the important nodes of activity that he's been part of, including the Rochester world that led to a Bucknell University world, and then to the University of Rochester and the Manhattan School of Music, and being in the right place at the right time of the dawn of the 1960s in New York, and the very fruitful activity through the 60s that includes Falwell as part of Carla Bley's group, one of the founding members of the group called the Uni Trio that was born in Panama among servicemen, Perry Robinson, Tom Price, and Bill Falwell himself, who had been mustered in at the Navy School of Music in Washington, D.C. And the Uni Trio, upon coming back to New York, became part of the fabric of what I guess really is the underground of free music activity in New York, and somehow after years of not having anything to show for it except perhaps the occasional newspaper cutting, there is a deeper story there that's been at least touched on in today's program by the telling and by the playing of music, and will be expanded later on. This is the same fellow, Bill Falwell, who you heard speaking at length on the topics relating to his interactions with one of the seminal figures of the new music of the 60s, Albert Eiler, in whose groups he played across the end of that decade. And then hopefully not short shrifting it too much, a summary of the next 10 years in speech and a compacted speech by Bill Falwell himself, who I'm pleased to say is still keeping on in Florida, still paying attention to what was meaningful about earlier times, and still paying attention that these times include some important study of music as he continues to practice as a teacher and band leader and organizer, and that we continue to understand what it is that's important and gravitate toward it. Thanks to Bill Falwell for these insights and for being there to make this music to start with and keeping around to put it into our ears. This has been our Jazz Profiles offering for our last program in July. The show returns 1 week from today, of course, from 2 until 7 p.m. every week. Don't forget that 6 days from right now, Louis Armstrong will be the topic under consideration in an entire day of broadcasting, honoring Satchmo on his birthday anniversary. And in just a few minutes, we'll cross into a different program with Rog Artal, I believe hosted by Charlie Blass this evening. My name is Ben Young. Pleased to have been here with you, and we'll close out with another brilliant segment of music from the Uni Trio, Perry Robinson, Tom Price, and our featured artist today, Bill Falwell, on the bass.
Thank you.